Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Welcome to Wall Street Unspun. This is Hemanth Kathuria, branch manager for Euro Pacific Capital, Los Angeles. For those of you who are tuning into the show and expecting to hear Peter Schiff, he is away. He is on the actually in the air right now on a trip to Poland, and he is speaking before in a gathering of global economists. As you've probably heard, Peter is becoming more and more in demand. It's funny because the demand for his views, I guess, is more outside of the United States than it is inside. They seem to have a better understanding of what's going on in our economy and the issues that we're facing, and maybe the typical American is just too close to the situation, is just understanding and listening to what the propaganda guys on CNBC and the other media outlets are force-feeding them. That will change. There are more people that have been coming over to our way of thinking, whether it's through their affiliation with Ron Paul or his son Rand Paul, or the different type of things that they've been doing. HR 1207 is still out there, and we're seeing where that takes us. There's a lot of people who understand that the status quo that Wall Street and the politicians in Washington have been force-feeding us is not the way to go. It's not going to be a situation that is resolved by more of the same, the pouring gasoline on the fire, et cetera. I mean, it's an issue that can only be resolved with fresh thinking. Peter Schiff, luckily, is getting more and more of an audience that understands that. Well, it's been a year since I've hosted the show by myself. In that period since then, there have been several people from my branch here in the Brentwood area that have hosted the show, including John Down, Stephen Echevarria, and Neeraj Chaudhary. But as far as me hosting it solo, it's been exactly 1 year. Now, what has happened during that last year? It's been very interesting. We've seen a big consolidation in the markets as far as gold, silver, precious metals, foreign stocks. September 3rd of last year is when I hosted the show, and I was talking back then about a correction that we were in the midst of in the gold mining sector. Now, at that point, let's talk about the GDX, which is the gold miner index. The GDX was around 35 and was still falling. Now, the gold mining index is notoriously volatile. Is subject to violent corrections. And going back to what we were discussing in that show, and several callers had called in and asked questions about what our expectations as a firm were for the GDX and for even the junior miners and the prospects for physical gold and silver as well as platinum, the things that we were experiencing were within normal parameters. Yes, 2008 was a big extreme, especially in the silver market, which retraced most of the bull market temporarily. But we have seen a bounce off those lows, and we are in a bullish configuration currently. You've got the moving averages, the 50-day, which is above the 100-day, which is above the 200-day, all in bullish alignment. The GDX today hit a level of 45, which was natural resistance from the June highs around 44.5. We did slam right into that resistance and consolidate. So a lot of our clients and a lot of the listeners, I'm sure, have questions regarding what we see going forward, not only for gold and for silver, but for the markets in general, the dollar. I'm going to run a few of the statistics by, and then we'll be in a position to take some calls. For those of you who are interested in calling in and asking questions, the number is 1-888-678-9597. The other item of interest that you might be asking is, where is the Schiff for Senate campaign? I would direct you to the schifforsenate.com website. You'd be surprised to see the current total of the donations that have come in for Peter's potential run, and that is something that's looking more and more likely, but once again, go to the Schiff for Senate campaign website to get more information on that. Let's run down the numbers. The Dow Jones, around 9,500, is trading around 9.5 ounces of gold. We think that the Dow will eventually bottom out at 1x gold. I mean, it's happened a couple times in history, and that is the end game, the massive inflation that has been created by not only our central bank, but the world's central bankers, is making this something that's baked in the cake. It is not a question of if, it's just a question of when. The other markets of interest, the U.S. dollar index, 77.02, continues to break down from that pennant formation, a very bearish configuration. We think that the U.S. dollar index could settle at a level of half current the current level within the next several years. Now, think about that. The world central banks are also inflating, but the dollar is so weak that it is going to be devalued against those other currencies. So if you do not have an account with your Pacific Capital, I encourage you to call in to the use the 800 number, which is 800-727-7922, or call into any of the branches on the West Coast or Scottsdale that still have brokers in them. Our local number here in Los Angeles is 310-826-2975. There are brokers standing by to take your call. The other markets, we've got platinum, 1276. You might recall briefly that platinum actually got below gold at the height of the deflation scare. It is consolidating and moving higher. Palladium is at 290. And silver, my favorite metal, I would say, just because of the bullish prospects with silver being a monetary metal, but also being an industrial metal. Silver today is at 1634. Looking back at one of our favorite silver investments that I've been buying since last year, and I own it personally through the convertible debentures, and I own it for clients in large amounts. The stock also trades on it trades in Canada, and it trades here in the U.S. I've invited Brad Cook, the CEO of Endeavor Silver, to join me on this call. For those of you who are a silver bug or a gold bug or a somebody who sees that inflation out there and have questions regarding the prospects for silver and for investing in precious metals, I encourage you to call in. You'll be able to speak both with myself and with Brad. I don't know, Brad, are you on the air?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, Brad, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, actually. How about you?
Good, good. How's the weather up there in Canada?
You know what? We are coming into our rain season, unfortunately, but it's been a beautiful summer.
Well, let me ask you a few questions. In fact, I'm just going to ask you to take this free form. Why don't you fill the viewers in on what you feel is currently happening in the silver market, and then maybe you can let us know a little bit about what's going on with Endeavor Silver.
By all means, I think a good place to start would just be a 60-second overview on the last 6 years in the silver market.
Great.
Because that really points to the genesis of my company, Endeavor Silver Corp. As your listeners are all well aware, the price of gold in U.S. dollars entered into a new secular bull market in March of 2001 and really followed a pretty exponential curve up to its peak in early 2008. Everybody's aware of the sharp sell-off last year, and yet here we are barely a year after the global economic meltdown, and gold's making new highs in the U.S. dollar. Silver, being the poor man's gold, is effectively a mirror to gold. It typically allows gold to lead and then plays catch-up. It follows gold. And so Silver took a full 2 years, 2.5 years, to actually join the party, and really the secular bull market for silver in U.S. dollars started in November of 2003. If you then look at the chart on silver over these last 6 years, what you'll see is that there was three waves between 2003 and 2009, where silver lagged for a good year, year and a half behind the price of gold, and then the door would slam shut and it would play catch-up in a hurry, expressed as a gold-silver ratio. The start of the cycle, the ratio was somewhere around 60 or 70 to 1, and with each successive wave where silver closed the gap between gold and silver prices, then you saw that ratio fall to 55, 50, 45, and at the peak of those metals in 2008, the gold-silver ratio got as low as 42 to 1. At the bottom of the sell-off last fall, that ratio fell as deep as 85 to 1.
Now, isn't the ratio of gold to silver in the Earth's crust more like 16 to 1?
Well, yes, and that actually is a very interesting fact, because for the better part of a century leading up until the 1930s, the price of silver was actually fixed relative to the price of gold at, interestingly enough, 16 to 1.
Sure. It's a it's something that we speak to the clients, and they want gold because the reputation of gold is that it is the ultimate form of money. And then I have to remind them that it's been thousands of years, and silver has also equally been regarded as money. It's just the last, possibly this generation, that has kind of moved away from that. But I think it's more of a brainwashing just from various entities like the Silver Users Association and the industrial users who benefit from a lower price of silver.
There are very few people now on the face of the planet who actually remember silver as money, and yet it was the last physical form of precious metal coinage.
Absolutely.
You know, not only in the U.S., but Mexico and China were big, big users of silver as coins.
Well, I hold quite a bit of the Morgan dollars and the Peace dollars and the various coinage that has existed. And, I mean, I pull out a coin every once in a while just to remind myself that this is real money. This is the only real money that I feel secure holding besides gold and platinum. And the paper dollars that are being printed in infinite supply are basically just a claim on the credit of the country which is printing this money. And, you know, what good is that when all is said and done? You want to have something that's real and tangible.
I think that's what makes gold and silver precious. There is an intangible appreciation of their uniqueness in
nature. Why don't you tell us about what's going on with Endeavor Silver in particular?
Well, of course. When I saw that gap between gold and silver in 2002, I decided I'd better get into the silver business. I myself am a professional geologist with 32 years in the mining business, but mostly in gold. And so in late 2002, we founded Endeavor Silver. We went to Mexico in 2003 thinking that it was a good time to acquire strategic silver properties, silver assets. And, you know, the traditional mine model for finding and developing mines takes typically 5 or 10 years, where you go looking for an ore body, find one, evaluate its economics, go through all the painful permitting and financing and construction. Mm-hmm. What we found in Mexico in 2003 were numerous fully built and permitted mines and processing facilities, mills.
Well, Mexico has a deep history of silver mining. They actually, it's funny because they, according to me, they should be one of the richest countries in the world if they had made some better decisions along the centuries.
Well, and, you know, unfortunately, when real money, silver, is easy to acquire, then, unfortunately, governments tend to let it go just as easily. So Mexico lived off of the silver industry for the better part of 450 years. It was really the emergence of petroleum, actually, in the late 30s that allowed Mexico to switch from having effectively a silver-backed economy to a petroleum-backed economy.
Now, I believe they have Cantarell, which is Pemex's main field, is in a terminal state of decline. The last figures I read that they were experiencing a 13% year-over-year decline in production, which is really something that brings it all home, that all these resources are very, very precious, and they should be treated accordingly. The politicians and the the various governments that tend to use these things and act like they're just free money to be spent and they're limitless in limitless supply really need to go back and do their homework and realize that this is something that needs to be not exploited, but be rationed. I mean, it's not something that it takes millions of years for oil to be created, cooked up by the earth. And then the way that they just waste these resources is just, it's just a shame.
Well, the irony about petroleum in Mexico is that it was originally nationalized principally to protect it from the marauding foreign investors. And as you know, the government of Mexico became more and more reliant on the petroleum revenues
sure.
in order to support all of its social programs and spending, to the point where 3 years ago it represented fully 35% of the government budget.
Yeah.
Now with the crash of production at Cantarell, the Mexican government is obviously looking for other sources of revenue. I'm not that much of a pessimist, though, on Cantarell, and I'll tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
Every year or so elsewhere in the Gulf, there have been substantial giant and even supergiant oil finds. In fact, there was one announced 2 weeks ago, but it's at 6 miles deep.
Well, I think the big Tupi field that Petrobras found out there is probably a good example of that.
Well, exactly. But my point is simply this, that the Cantarell field being drilled out and developed by the government mm-hmm. is really only typically 10,000 to 15,000 feet. And
sure.
so the entire 15,000 feet below that is basically unexplored. So I do believe if Mexico wakes up to opportunities to bring in maybe public-private partnerships to accelerate
that was going to be my question. Don't they have to change the Constitution to allow foreign investors, which really are the deep pockets that are required to exploit these resources?
And it has started. It started in 1993 with the liberalization of the mining code to allow for 100% foreign investment,
mm-hmm.
thanks to NAFTA. And now there are public-private partnerships for pipelines onshore.
I
think
there
it's only
hope.
A matter of time
Good.
Until they spread to the offshore.
Well, let's see if that if they can muster the political will not to squander those resources once they are able to start bringing them up and learn from the mistakes of the past.
And as you know, those things take time, luck, and a substantial amount of capital. So
sure.
Mexico really wants to get going if it's going to sustain its levels of petroleum production.
Now, you acquired your two mines, forgive me if I butcher the pronunciation, but Guanajuato and Guanacaví.
Hey, that's very good.
Okay.
Guanajuato.
And you bought those from Peñoles, is that correct?
We did. So this tour of mining assets that started mm-hmm. in 2003 culminated with meeting Peñoles and recognizing that they had non-producing and non-core silver mines that were fully built, permitted, and about to close.
Gotcha.
We recognized an opportunity to turn the mining cycle upside down, and instead of spending years looking for an ore body and then, permitting and building it, buying something that's already built and permitted and go look for an ore body.
Okay.
That was really what made Endeavor, and our business model has been so successful. It's been copied now by many others.
Well, I'm looking here at a chart of your stock, and it certainly, the picture is 1,000 words. It looks like you're doing something right because the stock's been moving up quite nicely here. What do you, I know you're probably not in a position to project what your price would be, but what do you see in general for your for silver prices and the obvious effect that it would have on your business going forward?
Well, we do annual forecasting internally just to be able to estimate mm-hmm. our cash flows for the year, and that obviously governs our capital expansion programs.
Sure.
So, for instance, this year's forecast was in the $14 million range of mine operating cash flow, thanks to the more aggressive move in the price of silver and the reduction in our cash operating costs. We're now looking at as much as $18 million in free cash flow, free operating cash flow this year. So it's been a good year for us.
Right.
And we, looking forward at the silver price, think now that we're coming into one of those unique six-month periods that you'll see three times in the last 6 years in the silver chart,
okay.
where the move starts in September and culminates in April. And that move typically can be as much as 50%.
Now, do you think the actual drought in India is going to have any effect on the prospects for the physical market in both gold and silver?
To be honest, the fundamental supply and demand of silver has more to do with the price in stable markets where the economy is good. And when the economy is struggling and there's much more of a financial or investment aspect to the demand side, then I think the physical supply and demand becomes much less of a factor. So I think the main driver is investment demand.
Has it helped, actually? I mean, in a perverse way, with the byproduct silver from zinc and lead and all the mines that have come offline over the last year, I would imagine that would even further physically constrain the market.
Well, absolutely. As you can imagine, when the global economy is chugging along, copper, gold, and zinc mines that all produce byproduct silver are also chugging along.
Sure.
And when there's an economic turndown and people start reducing their physical inventories of copper, zinc, and gold, then, of course, they stop producing byproduct silver. It does have a significant impact on the supply side.
Okay. What we can do, we've got callers backing up here, so let's try to talk to a few of the callers who've been waiting very patiently. I've got Chad in Minnesota, who's been holding for well over 18 minutes. Chad, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here. Good, thanks.
What? How can we help you?
Well, I first had a question on life insurance real quick, but then I was listening to the gentleman speak, and I didn't catch his name, but is Endeavor a takeover candidate? Would they, you know, if what the right offer, would they?
Oh, well, let's start off with Endeavor. Brad, why don't you take that one?
Wow, that's a good question, and I think the long answer is yes, but not no.
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Our advisor with Euro Pacific put us in a little bit of your stock and been pretty happy. We got in about $2 a share, which was a great price. But my other question, I had just got set up with life insurance with our family. And I've been
what type of life insurance? Term, whole life,
term,
universal?
Term.
Okay, good.
Term. And my question is now that I'm set up, I think $350,000.
How old are you?
36.
Okay.
And now if the dollar keeps losing value and it keeps getting hammered like this, and now I've got a decent sum in Euro-Pacific.
Sure.
Don't you think the life insurers are going to find people thinking, okay, the dollar's worth this, let's start canceling our term? And now, is this going to put tremendous pressure on the life insurers down the road, possibly?
Well, you've got a situation. Would you get 10-year level term or 20-year?
20.
Okay, 20-year level term. So you've got a policy similar to what I have. I mean, the way I look at it is I've got a fixed premium, which is a very, very small amount.
Right.
If you buy term insurance the correct way and use it for what is properly designed, it has its place. I mean, you're paying that premium in a devaluing currency, and the benefit is also in a devaluing currency. So the situation is kind of a netting process. You probably, because the currency is devaluing, need to have further policies in place. Now, your policy with Euro Pacific Capital becomes a policy which is an insurance from loss of purchasing power, which is what it all comes down to, because in this type of environment, you need to have assets that are rising with the inflation that's rising out there. Wouldn't you agree, Brad?
Yeah, actually, when you look at the amount of growing money supply just in the last year, there's only one inevitable consequence, and that is inflation, another reason to own the precious metals.
Yes. So, Chad, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I never thought of it that way as far as, you know, what you're paying in yearly is also then if you have money with, you know, out of the dollars.
Sure. The insurance companies, I mean, on one level, they may understand inflation, but they really run their business model in terms of static money supply. They really look at everything in nominal terms. And so their modeling is based on inflation numbers, which come from, you know, the CPI, which, you know, those numbers are basically meaningless. They don't really give any indication of the type of money being created by our central bankers. And that's the actual inflation, which is in the pipeline. That's baked into the cake. That's what we can't stop. That channel of inflation will filter in to prices. We're starting to see it in the precious metals the same way we started to see it at the birth of this bull market, which is, you know, basically 18 months after all the money, the monetary base, which expanded dramatically right before Y2K. So you had Greenspan come in and pump up the monetary base. It took 18, 19 months, and all of a sudden you bam, it hits, and you suddenly are aware of the inflation, but the money had been created and filtered through the economy prior to that. So we're in the same cycle now, except that Bernanke has popped up the money supply by over 90%. So it's that monetary base expansion will filter in to everything, and then all of a sudden the Main Street economists will all of a sudden think, oh, well, inflation has started. Well, the inflation's already there. It's that's already we're into that part of it. So, you know, you should keep adding your Euro-Pacific Capital account. If you've got Endeavor and you've got good foreign stocks, it's going to be a good protection from this devaluation. You've seen the dollar index and what's happening there. It's a situation where, you know, continue to do what you're doing, and you'll be well served.
Sure, sure. One more quick question. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of anybody ever, you know, back on the insurance, getting a policy, like, say, in Canadian dollars? I mean, is that possible as a U.S. citizen?
Good question. I mean, there was, I believe, Allianz was issuing foreign-denominated policies, but I'm not an insurance agent.
Right, right.
It's something that you would probably have to call an insurance agent
who
would be able to answer that question in a better fashion.
Sounds good.
Thanks for the call, Chad.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and take David in Seattle. David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How are you?
Pretty good. You're talking about just the thing I wanted to talk about, and I want to preface it by saying that I believe that we're going to have significant inflation too, but there are a lot of deflationists out there.
Absolutely. You look at the Elliott Wave guys. They have just had to redraw all their wave counts once again. They've been bearish on the metals for quite some time. You had Prechter on CNBC calling for a top, not only in the metals, but in various commodity markets, oil, et cetera. Now that that we have invalidated those forecasts, they're going to have to redraw those lines once again. What we've been doing and what I've been putting clients into is a lot of products that actually protect from both sides. I mean, the convertible bonds that will be bought, which are backed by precious metals, those have done very well. Even the product we did with Brad with Endeavor Silver, which were convertible debentures, that, you know, these kind of things give you exposure to the metal, but they also will protect you from a short-term disinflation. I mean, let's face it, the money supply is still growing, so we have the inflation. We just don't see the effects of it yet. That doesn't mean it's not lurking out there.
So you don't think there is a possibility, I don't either, but you don't think there, I mean, currently the Fed, yeah, expanded the monetary base, but obviously expanded it past any previous monetary expansion.
Correct.
But the top of the pyramid, the banks are not lending.
The velocity of money argument. It's funny because I talked to an insider, somebody who is an unnamed source who works at Bank of America. He's in lending, and he's since Bank of America has effectively been taken over by the U.S. government, they have opened up the spigots, and they are being encouraged to lend. Those lending standards have actually come down in certain segments. So you're seeing a lot of activity in certain price ranges. You're also seeing the tax credit of $8,000 being proposed to be extended and actually increased to $15,000. Believe me, the things that Peter wrote about in Crash Proof are all coming to fruition. He warned in Crash Proof that you should not worry about the classic retracement that is mandatory. I mean, let's face it, we're in the Austrian School of Economics. We understand that every boom must be followed with a bust. So Peter said, Don't worry about that. Embrace it. You need to worry about what the government might do to try to counteract that. That is the danger. And so that's what we're seeing right now in Congress. And believe me, you're going to see a lot more harebrained stuff than this coming up. I mean, when the double-dip cycle of this recession really starts resuming in earnest is when you're going to see the politicians, you know, throw up their hands and say, what next? What do we have to do? They're going to pour more gasoline on the fire, and there's going to be more harebrained schemes that they come up with. I mean, you know, hopefully we can get cooler heads, but it's doubtful.
Yeah, I guess the only contrarian to that could be the Fed. They're still somewhat independent, but anyway, yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, as far as a hedge also against the U.S. dollar, I've invested in a fair amount in Australia.
Good. Australia is a good country. You've got a lot of the type of parameters that we look at. Less population, more resources. They ran budget surpluses for many years in a row, and they have the mining sector of their economy, which has come to the forefront now. The financial sector obviously had trouble because they followed the U.S. blueprint, which was not good. The Asian banks did it the right way. They didn't take on a lot of leverage, so they came out better. But luckily, Australia has enough resources where it can come out of this just fine. But, David, it was great talking to you. I've got callers backed up here. I'm going to have to take Philip.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Philip in Vienna. Philip, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I know that Peter is a big promoter of renting versus buying home.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm 27. I'm married, got two kids, and my wife and I, we bought our condo for $285,000 at the peak of the housing bubble.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the prices have dropped pretty dramatically. They're now selling for about $200,000.
What's your market? Is that in Vienna?
In Vienna, yeah, in our local market. So, if we want to get out of our place, talk to some real estate agents, we're probably going to have to bring about $80,000 in cash to the table.
If it's an owner-occupied property, you might be able to qualify for one of these government programs and actually get the bank to agree to do a short sale. There are programs out there which I believe they've changed it so you don't get too much of a ding to your credit, and you can actually do a short sale and get some of that forgiven.
Well, is that what you would recommend? I mean, that's basically my question. What should I do in my situation? Should I,
I don't know your local market, but I can tell you that when prices get three standard deviations from historical mean, when I'm talking about prices versus rents, prices versus median income, prices versus CPI, prices have to revert. Now, we had a chart that we look at on a national basis, which is the price of real estate from 1900 to 1995. And we overlaid that chart with the price of the CPI chart. Guess what? It's the same chart. You look at CPI and you looked at the real estate prices, they were overlaid almost, the correlation was 0.94. Now, what happened? 1995, Alan Greenspan embarked on the pain of doubling the money supply. From 1995 to 2006, he took the whole 200-plus year history of this country's money supply and he doubled it. So you see the chart go near vertical. And this time it's different crowd came out and started sounding their horns that you can't go wrong in real estate. So we got three standard deviations above these different metrics that you use. I mean, you had properties here in California that were going on the commercial side. You had properties going for a 2 and 3 cap, which doesn't make any sense if you can stick your money in bonds and get 6%. But that's what was happening in 2004 and 2005. It's a situation where in your particular market, how many square foot is your house?
It's really tiny, about 1,000 square foot, which is why we're looking to move out. I'm also afraid that the housing prices are just going to continue to fall.
Well, what's going to happen is, I mean, you have some natural floors. The reason I ask for the square footage is you have the construction, the replacement cost of a property is one of those floors that I look at. I mean, without knowing your particular area, it's hard to give you more of a specific answer, but if I had to say that the economy in general and the real estate market, which will follow that, is due for further pain, the answer is unequivocally yes. We in the U.S., we still have too much leverage in the system. You've seen the savings rate exploding. You've seen that that is impacting all types of commercial real estate now. Also, the big box mall operators, you have had a client come in here the other day who does leasing for these types of properties, and he was talking about prices which had come down from $13 a square foot to $6 a square foot. So it's a calamity out there in certain sectors. There are certain sectors which are probably closer to the bottom, and whether Vienna, Virginia is one of them, it's hard for me to say. But in general, yes, prices are going to drop.
Okay, so you think I should try to take advantage of a government program.
Talk to an agent locally in your market and ask about the programs as far as the forgiveness and the possibility of doing a short sale, which may not have the dramatic impact on your credit like it would have had in the past. That has changed, so you should probably look at that, and you might be able to, the situation might not be nearly as dire as you think.
Okay. Well, we'd actually talked to our agent about doing a short sale originally, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I was under the impression that that was when, during hard financial times when you can't afford to pay the mortgage, then you take
Yeah, there are specific requirements that must be met to qualify for that. That is true. So without okay. knowing your details, which is probably not a conversation to have over the air, it would be hard for me to advise you further. But,
okay.
Philip, it's been thanks for taking the time to give us a call today.
Yep,
I'm going to have to move on here. I've got Patrick calling from Slovakia in Europe. Patrick, are you there? Hello, Patrick. Patrick, are you there? Well, it looks like we've lost Patrick. Unfortunately, he held for 31 minutes, so sorry about that, Patrick, but I'm going to have to move on. We've got Tom in Newport Beach. Tom, how are you today?
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Newport Beach, I used to work out of that office back in 2007. So how's it going?
Going well.
What can I do for you today?
I was wondering what you thought about buying some lumber futures contracts, considering all this money they're printing has to come somewhere.
Well, think about it this way. I'm going to talk about two things here. First of all, Brad could probably weigh in on this too, as far as how the futures markets are constructed and the contango, which comes from the pricing. Brad, I know you're probably very well versed in the contango in the silver market, but as far as the general futures markets, doesn't that translate to all commodities?
That used to be the case, but if you actually look at the silver forward market today, the contango is extremely small.
Okay, so that it has closed up. I remember in the past, we actually had gotten a backwardization at one point in 2004, 2005, and then it's been going back and forth since then. I'm not really sure, Tom, on the lumber market, and I'll explain a little bit to the viewers who are listening and what the contango is. I mean, you have interest, insurance, and storage costs that are part of the price of a futures contract. So you might have a September lumber, which is trading at a certain price, and December or March lumber, which is trading at a higher price. So those prices, the difference in that price is the contango. That is factoring in all these various costs, the interest, insurance, storage, et cetera. Now, the second part of my response would probably be the physical market of lumber and what moves that market. And as you could probably guess, it has to do a lot with real estate, construction, et cetera. Manufacturing activity in general. So, Tom, what has made you focus in on the lumber market in particular?
Actually, I was just almost kind of making a joke. I heard someone talking about all the money they were printing, and
mm-hmm.
they were saying all this money is going to have to come from somewhere.
Yeah, well,
about the lumber.
Think about it this way: there's a lot of trees out there, but there's not that many silver mines. So maybe you'd be better off going out and buying some real money. Just getting some gold, getting some silver, getting some platinum, you'll probably be in a better position. I mean, think about it this way. All the gold, I'll use gold for an example here, all the gold that's ever come out of the Earth's crust, 5,000 years, whether it's hanging around a woman's neck in India or whether it's in a bar supposedly in Fort Knox, even though Fort Knox hasn't been audited since 1959, but let's assume it's there, all that gold together would really only be a 23 by 23 meter cube. That's not a lot of gold. I mean, that'd be sitting on
right.
the outfield of Dodger Stadium out here. You can only increase that cube by 1.5% a year. That's how precious it is. And the characteristics with silver are even more bullish. You've got billions of ounces that were with both China and with the U.S. when silver was coinage. We were on a bimetallic standard for generations. Now, when that happened, we moved off that. And we actually started dishoarding all that silver. That silver was used up by industry. So you've got billions and billions of ounces. I mean, Brad, you probably know the exact number better than I do, but that's all gone. Isn't that burned up by industry permanently?
Yeah, in the silver business, it's a bit different than gold. industrial offtake is a multiple of the jewelry and precious metal offtake. So all of that industrial offtake disappears and doesn't come back. If you think about it, silver is the best natural conductor on the face of the planet. So every sure. electronic gadget, which has electronic conductors, has each conductor has a conductive surface has a film of silver on it. The price of silver does not affect the price of the gadget because there's such a little amount required.
Yeah, the marginal cost and the increase in silver would not affect it. So if a cell phone uses a certain amount of silver and silver doubles in price, it's not going to make the price of the cell phone double. It's, the cell phone might go up by, you know, a marginal amount. So, Tom, I advise you to go out there and you know, get some precious metals, some precious metal stocks or some other type of entity. Maybe, you know, take a chart, look at the chart of Endeavor Silver. I mean, these are companies that in the future are going to be paying big dividends as this bull market matures and as the money creation at the source from all these central banks keeps ratcheting up. And I've got Patrick from Slovakia back on the line. Patrick, are you there?
Hey there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Okay, well, how can we help you today?
Sure.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm calling in from Slovakia. I've got a question. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. What exactly is your question today?
Oh, okay, very good. I'd like to know your opinion on...
Are you okay there, Patrick?
I'm doing very well. I'd just
right.
like to know your opinion.
Patrick, I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go. It's been good talking to you. Tony from Peoria. Tony, are you there?
Yes, how are you doing?
Good. I'm actually just enjoying that last caller who apparently had one too many. But, you know, it is 2 a.m. in Slovakia right now, so I can't really blame him.
Yeah, so maybe not enough.
Yeah. How can I help you?
I wanted to get your opinion on a place to store like the what would typically just be sitting in savings. You know, your emergency fund, if I were to lose mm-hmm. my job fund, or I need to buy a...
Junk silver.
You know, for my refrigerator that gone out.
You know what? I've got, you know, personally, I can just speak from personal experience. I mean, I've got an accumulated amount of various forms of small denominated real money. Now, whether that's a fractional ounce of gold or an actual physical coinage that represents silver, whether it's Morgan dollars or Peace dollars or actual... you know, the junk silver from the pre-1961, there's physical ways to keep that. Now, I'd still say you should spread it around. So if you have an emergency fund, there are ways you can do it in your brokerage account at Euro Pacific Capital. That could be through the Merck Hard Currency Fund or the Merck Asian Fund. I mean, those funds are not too volatile. If you want to do it yourself, I believe there's an ETF you could probably buy that tracks the Chinese renminbi. So there's ways that you can still kind of be out of the dollar, but still fairly liquid. You will have some volatility, but it won't be the same as like physically owning a stock.
Yeah. I've actually got some of it sitting in the Mercard Currency Fund right now.
Good.
I am a Europac customer.
Good.
And I wanted to know if you thought something like the FXA for the Australian dollar or the FXY for the...
You know what?
I'm
looking at those things. I mean, as you know, the Australian dollar had peaked out at 96 cents in 2008. Had pulled down to 60 cents. Currently, it's back at around 86 cents. So it's retraced most of the move. If you're looking at something which is short-term money, I want you to just look at a chart of the Australian dollar for the last year and think: are that type of volatility? I mean. Interest rates have dropped, so those ETFs aren't going to pay you a lot of yield. It's not going to compensate you from a big drop if you're going to need that money. So keep that in mind. The reason I like the Chinese renminbi is that it's semi-managed. I mean, you've got a currency which is going to float higher by 3, 4, 5% a year. So even if the yield is almost zero on the ETF, yeah, you know you're not going to have a big drawdown in it. I mean, there's no guarantees, obviously. Prices are going to fluctuate with demand because an ETF is tradable. But there is at least an idea of the volatility by looking at the chart from the last 6 months and the last 1 year. Last year, as you saw in those ETFs, I think the FXF was the one that rose, which is a Swiss franc ETF. You can't go out to Switzerland and buy any kind of paper right now under 3 years that has a yield. You go out and buy a Swiss government bond 2 and 3 years out, you got a negative yield on that thing. So it is tougher. That is a question which really comes down to one thing. What's your time frame? If it's something that you might need the money right away, it's a tougher call. If your time frame is a little bit further out, the call becomes a lot easier.
Okay.
Okay. So thanks for the call, Tony. I hope we answered your question. And once again, I'm going to announce the number for people who still want to ask a question. We do have a few minutes left on the show. It's 888-678-9597. You've got me today, but Peter will be back from Prague by next Wednesday's show, so you'll be able to take your call then. For now, let me take John from Destin, Florida. John, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call.
How you doing? It looks like we just lost him. John, are you there?
Okay. In regards to silver. And one thing I was curious about, and I really haven't seen anything on the web that gives me a straight answer. Probably haven't looked hard enough. But is silver taxable as a store of value?
Brad, you want to take that one?
Is silver taxable? Well, I guess if you buy physical silver and resell it, then you'd be looking at a capital gain because silver would be considered an asset.
Okay, so basically, if you had a capital gain on the silver, then yeah, I guess it would be taxable.
And you're probably looking at an ordinary income too, because the way I understand it is that the government has taken the adverse opinion that that these are collectibles, and so you're looking at a higher tax rate even if you hold it for 1 year. I mean, there are ways to, of course, capture the long-term capital gains rate. If you're buying a silver miner, for example, or even if you're buying Central Fund of Canada, you might be able to capture a better tax rate. You should check with your CPA on that. But it is definitely, there is going to be some form of taxation.
Okay. I was wondering about that, and I was specifically talking about physical silver.
Mm-hmm.
Another question, I guess, while I have you, or comment, I do have 25% in silver. I do think that it's a good investment or store of value, however you want to frame it.
Sure.
But also, too, I got pretty much all my investment advice from listening to Peter over the last few months. But I did some research on the site on Norway and have invested heavily in Norway stocks.
Uh-huh.
And just, one, because of the currency play, it's a really good currency. And
sure.
Based on my research, they haven't done any quantitative easing. So, I look there, and there are a few good companies, I think, that are good plays in Norway, and just wanted your comments.
Norway is the best-kept secret out there. I mean, they've got the highest per capita reserve of any country on Earth. The Norwegian krone is where it was in 2004. So think about the last 5 years and how the tremendous amount of offshore oil revenue has increased the net wealth of Norway. Every single year, they've done all the right things. They've lived, within their means. They've been conservative. Their aggregate balance sheet of the country of Norway has improved. Yet, the currency is right where it was in 2004 versus the dollar, even though every year since 2004, the net balance sheet of the United States has gotten worse. So you're right on track there. If you have a Euro-Pacific Capital account, we can give you specific names. Call into your broker. If you don't have an account, there are brokers standing by. If you should call in, we'll get you names that trade right in Oslo, companies that have bullish charts, that have bullish fundamentals, and that have dividend yields, and they're denominated in the local Norwegian currency. So definitely you did the right thing by starting and doing some homework on your own, and now you should take it to the next step and move that forward and actually make some purchases either in Norwegian equity or even possibly Norwegian fixed income for larger amounts. So it's definitely a solid play.
Okay. Well,
all right.
That kind of backs up my research. I appreciate you taking my call this evening.
Very good. It was good talking to you. I've got Joe in Buffalo. Joe, are you there? Hello, Joe in Buffalo, are you there? Looks like we lost Joe. I'm going to move on to Mickey in Boca Raton, Florida. Mickey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, so first of all, I am an Indian student, and okay. I'm studying in Florida, Boca Raton.
Okay.
I had a few questions regarding the Indian economy.
Sure.
My first question is that what do you think about the real estate in India, especially the mid-sized towns there?
It's been a while. I was in India in March of 07. Now, yeah. As you know, I mean, if I'm assuming that you've been there probably more recently than I have. You go and you get off at the international airport there in Delhi, and as soon as you get on the road, there's flyovers being constructed everywhere.
Uh-huh.
It's completely jam-packed. I mean, the pollution in Delhi itself has just been out of control. I mean, it was even with the change to all the three-wheelers and the buses to CNG as their fuel, it still is literally choking. So the expansion has moved outward. The GT road, which goes north, has been paved over several times, and still the congestion is absolutely massive.
Yeah.
You go. I believe they're building a new international airport somewhere near Chandigarh. I'm not sure exactly what the city is, but there's expansion going out in every direction. I like the fact that India's demographics are they're favorable. I mean, let's face it, they've got the younger population, and that is going to support the tremendous growth in GDP that they've had. I also feel that at some point in the future, India will be the richest country in the world, just specifically just because of all the gold that they have. I mean, if we get the kind of moves that Peter's talking about in precious metals, let's face it, I mean, the typical Indian farmer who's sitting on gold that probably nobody else knows about, which is from all those harvests, all that little money that's gone on the side over the last decades, which is sitting somewhere in gold, they're going to be in a lot better position than they are right now with this the Washington Agreement and the 500 tons of gold that have been dumped on the market every year. You know, as the gold bull market continues and the IMF keeps trotting out these arguments about how they're going to sell their gold and doing whatever they can to prevent it, it's still going higher and higher and higher. And so, I'm bullish on the Indian economy. I think that the focus on production, the focus on work, the focus on education, let's face it, I mean, my dad came here in 1967, and he put himself through his MBA at over here in Northern California in San Francisco, and it's not easy. I mean, you got to put a lot of hours in, and you got to put the time and the work in. And so that work ethic actually translates, and that's been handed down in various generations. So in general, I still think that the direction is good. Manmohan Singh has done a lot of good things with opening up the country. I mean, you're going to have Walmarts, and you're going to have different kind of partnerships. I think the Maruti Suzuki thing with them going in and overtaking the Chinese in exports of automobiles. I mean, these are all bullish signs. Let's face it. You're going to have your share of blow-ups. I mean, the Satyam scandal was not pretty, but I mean that's what happens in a democracy. It is the biggest democracy in the world. So, the typical Indian's tendency to try to look outside of India to invest. You know, that's okay for diversification purposes, but right at home there's so many good places that you can put your money. So I'm I have a generally favorable view.
I had one more quick question.
Sure.
You guys were like bullish on gold.
Sure.
But you had based it on the premise that the dollar will weaken. So
mm-hmm.
gold in dollar terms will go up.
Sure.
But will it go up in terms of Indian rupees?
Take a look at the various currencies around the world. Now, I know the rupee has been one of the weaker currencies. I haven't looked at the exchange. What is it, around 48 right now?
Yeah, 48, 50 or something.
So you look at it in terms of rupees. Now, you've seen what's happened to the typical Indian buyer at the margin. They've backed off the market, especially with the drought this year. It's been very tough. You had a poor monsoon. And so despite all of that, the conditions that Brad was talking about earlier about how the investment demand is still there, and rupee gold is still breaking out to the upside. I mean, it looks like a nice, healthy uptrend to me. I mean, I think we are we're headed higher in every currency. I was looking at gold in terms of British pounds the other day, and I'm like, wow, this looks really solid. I mean, think back to the beginning of this bull market. We had gold originally only going up in dollars, and then in the first move, I believe it was the move over, Brad, what was it, 300 euros or 500 euros? I remember there was a big resistance there in euro terms. We finally broke above that, and we've never retraced to it.
Yeah.
So it's solid. I mean, I think gold's got the currency. So if you own gold, stick with it. If you do not own gold, definitely you should be getting some or getting some premier gold mining stocks. Hey, Mickey, we're running out of time, so I got to let you go. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I'm going to take Kate in Tampa, Florida. Kate, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually had a question in regard to education, and I was kind of glad that you mentioned it, I think, with the last caller. I have entered a PhD in economics just recently, and, you know, I'm working my way, thinking, of course, what exactly direction I will take for me to, be prosperous and as well as do what I love in the future. Obviously, PhD takes about 5 years, so the outlook that I'm thinking is what, 5 years ahead. In economics, what direction would you take if it was, let's say, FCU?
Well, let's look at that. I mean, I was an economics student myself. I was actually political science and economics. And, as you know, if you were to move on into the investment field or some type of business, both political science and economics are intertwined. So I would definitely look at, taking courses along those lines, which give you the exposure. Also, you should have the basic accounting background. I would definitely strongly encourage that. Whatever business you are going to end up going into with your accounting PhD, you are going to require those basic tools. I mean, that is the foundation that you'll need in business going forward. So if you're getting the educational background now, that needs to be supplemented with the different type of skill sets at the margin. And obviously, it will never replace real work experience. So whether it's internships or, we do have a Florida office that you might want to call down there in maybe next summer you could work down there and intern. I mean, there's different kind of real world experiences that I think everybody, if the opportunities are there, they should definitely take advantage of those. We had some real solid interns that we got in from UC Berkeley that worked for us this summer, and these guys, was a valuable experience for them, but it was also great for us because we get to see what the new generation of students can bring to the table. And there's a lot of new ideas, a lot of technological experience and advantages that these people have. They certainly think a lot quicker than we do after working in industry for 15, 20 years. You tend to slow down a little bit. But I hope I've answered your call. Your question?
Yes, indeed. I guess I was thinking that Peter always talks about that it might be a possibility or a desirable, outcome, actually, that a lot of people would immigrate or migrate from here to other countries, and I thought that a platform of PhD would give me a better chance and a better choices once I do immigrate, if that has to happen.
You know, what you've seen with Canada and Australia taking a lot of the visas for their higher education, because of what's happened here after September 11th, it's really given those other countries a benefit. But that's a conversation that we might have to have off the air at some point in the future. The last 10 seconds of the show is approaching. This hour went by very quickly. Brad, I really want to thank you for your participation in this show. It was absolutely phenomenal hearing a viewpoint for somebody in the industry who is as knowledgeable as you are. Peter will be back on the show next week, and we look forward to hearing you next week. Come back and with your questions. Thank you.